Hi, you are listening to a free Majority Report. If you would like to become a member, please go to majority.fm.
Yeah, say
your name. Oh, my name's Janine Garofalo. How are you?
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, November 8th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Cliff Schechter is off today. Joining us instead is Guy Lawson. And providing us a movie recommendation is the great Asif Manvi from The Daily Show. And also, actually, Beacock. Remind me about that. Nobody knows what Beacock is. Also on the program today, as we speak, John Kerry flying to Geneva. I don't know if he's landed there yet or what. But supposedly we're at the beginning of a deal with the Iranians. This is a big deal, folks. Not the deal itself, but the chance that we are making a deal is a big deal. I'll explain. Also on the program today, FDA still coming out banning trans fat. We hadn't talked about it yesterday. The Benghazi story has once again fallen apart. I didn't know that it got built back up. But it is once again fallen apart. George Bush is raising money for the mass conversions of Jews. Not clear yet whether or not we as Jews, or I as a Jew, will get some form of residual based on what he raises. But we will dig into that. Also, stunning statement. The statement itself is not so stunning, but who said it about the big banks is pretty stunning. Also, we'll talk with Guy about Stephen Cohen, the hedge funder who seems to have basically paid off the U.S. government so he doesn't have to go to jail. Well, it's just one of the benefits you get when you are a billionaire. Guy and I will also talk about the war on the poor, which I think, you know, the part of the story is also part of the Affordable Care Act, people pushing back on that. We will talk about all of that and more in just a moment. But folks, it is Friday. We know a lot of you tune in on Friday to get the weekly roundup. You don't listen to the rest of the week. Well, let me tell you folks something. You have 7 days in which you can vote to make the Majority Report the 3-time winner of Podcast Awards Best News and Politics Podcast. We are a 2-time winner, 2011, 2012. You go to podcastawards.com. You vote for the Majority Report in our two categories in which we have been nominated, People's Choice and Best News and Politics. You put your email address in at the bottom, your name. They verify the email. You got to go into your email and click it. I have never gotten a spam email from them. So there's no problem in giving you email. They just use it just to verify that your vote is legit. You can vote every day, which means that our competition is voting every day, which means that if you don't vote every day, you are you're basically saying, I don't think this is the deserving of the best news or politics podcast award. And in which case, I'm offended.
Or the People's Choice.
Or People's Choice, for that matter.
Which we've never won. So please, I guess we're not the people's choice.
Well,
perhaps this year. Perhaps this year.
Maybe this year. Maybe. If people, yes, it is a little bit of a hassle. It may take you 60 seconds out of your day. And remind yourself, put a little reminder on your phone just to give you an alert every day at 8 a.m. or first thing when you come in or when you put the kids to bed or when you send the kids off to school or when you have to pick up after your kids or when if your kid keeps waking up and you've got to go back into the room and you're not allowed to leave the house because the kids are complaining and whining. That's a good time to vote for us for podcastawards.com. All right, folks, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Guy Lawson. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure, ladies and gentlemen, to welcome back to the program my good friend, the author of The Octopus and the forthcoming. Well, when is the forthcoming one forthcoming?
Yeah, it's called Arms and the Dudes. It's with my publisher, Simon & Schuster, now. I'm waiting. I'm going to get the edit back next week. It'll either be a spring, summer, or fall book. That's sort of not my decision. So, but I'll be sure to let you know, Sam, of course.
All right. Well, let me get back to your intro. So he is the author of the New York Times bestseller, Octopus, Sam Israel, The Secret Market in Wall Street's Wildest Con. He's also you write for Rolling Stone. He also wrote The Brotherhoods, this true story of two cops who murdered the mafia, Rules of the Game. You're featured in a bunch of Canadian compendiums.
Well, there's some American ones too, but yes, I take that my Canadianness very seriously, man.
I understand. So Guy, let's start with a story that has been somewhat undercovered, and I know that you love to follow the cons of these hedge funders. Let's talk about Stephen Cohen. I also want to touch on this story about the Feds, the New York Fed chief's, charge or assessment of the banking industry. Yeah. And then I want to talk a little bit about how we juxtapose that with the idea of food stamp cuts this week. But
Sam Israel, my book Octopus is about a guy named Sam Israel who's running a massive Ponzi scheme, and he's doing 20 now and I think he's been in solitary for the last couple of months, so he just got out of the hole. But
why was he in solitary?
You know, he retains his personality, which is pretty defiant, and he didn't tell me why precisely, but one of the ways that they continue to punish you in prison is not just that you're in prison, but the medical system in prison is just truly dreadful, and so he's got a bunch of different medicines that he takes for pain and other ailments, and I think that it's a constant struggle with the authorities. And I know, for example, he doesn't have much hair, but what he's got, he's growing down to his his middle of his back as a political protest. So he's like a guy who's not, you know, doing his time quietly.
Right.
So, you know, but he, you know, I kind of admire him for it, actually, you know, the way that he's, you know, hung on to what, you know, what kind of pride he has. You know, the thing about the Stevie Cohen, I mean, they were next door neighbors in Greenwich, Connecticut. You know, there's Stevie, little Stevie. And, you know, Sam and I have been talking about what's been going on with Cohen. And, you know, his take on it is that Cohen's just better at cheating than anyone else, but he's also harder working. And that, you know, what the federal government's doing now is a combination of things with these fraud charges that they're bringing. You'll notice that they're all civil. So Chase Manhattan, JP Morgan get this $1 billion fine. And they use the word fraud, with Stevie Cohen, but no one's going to prison, right? But Sam's in prison. John Corzine's not going to prison. He could lose hundreds of former governor of New Jersey and a senator. It's almost like a measure of your power. If you have real power, you know, you can commit these frauds, but you're not going to go to jail because the systemic risk of everyone sort of actually, these really powerful people actually going behind bars. So they get little fish like Sam are the ones who do the time.
But there's really, but, I mean, look, the reality is that there is no systemic risk to send these people, or I guess it depends on what system we're talking about, right? I mean,
right.
And just to, you know, just back up over a minute and tell people a little bit more about Stephen A. Cohen, head of SAC Capital Advisors. Tell us just a little bit more about that story, because I don't think people realize the sort of the scope of this. Guy's made about, what, $9 billion? And
yeah,
apparently,
yeah. I mean, he basically, you know, all trading on some level at that, you know, certainly when you're talking the, running the amount of money that Stevie Cohen's running, right? He was running $15 billion. I think $9 billion of it was his. He had hundreds of traders and, you know, different kinds of trading was going on, but fundamentally, you know, trading is divides itself in two. There's trading on information, and then there's technical trading, which is trading on speed and trying to gain tiny little inefficiencies in the market, so-called inefficiencies. But both of those things are just like sewn up by Wall Street. You know, the insiders know how to get that information, and the insiders know how to obtain and keep secret the technical computer programming stuff that lets them trade ahead of the market. So Stevie Cohen was just a master of trading ahead of the market, and he had this incredible epic run of, you know, 15, 20 years of beating the market and beating it handily. And so, you know, after a time, you sort of wonder, well, how is he doing that? And, you know, it turns out that they've caught a few of the smaller fish at Stevie Cohen's shop that were insider trading. And, you know, it's a massive case of overcompensation. So the market was completely unregulated for decades, really ever. And all of a sudden, you know, in the light of Madoff and Sam Israel to some extent, but this sort of really the financial crisis and the Wizard of Oz-like nature of the markets, like how everyone's sort of looking at it and saying, what is going on? What's behind all that? So the government in a certain kind of way is propping up the market by, you know, making examples out of these folks. You know, I guess if you gave me the choice of, you know, you can make $9 billion, you got to give them $1 billion back, you get to keep $8 billion. You know, that's a pretty good deal for Stevie Cohen, right?
Yeah, I'd say it's a pretty good deal. I mean, you know, we don't have that kind of margin here. I mean, you know, I've got operating expenses in this office, and I would be glad to have a 1-to-9 ratio on expenses versus revenue. So let me just read a little bit what John Cassidy wrote in the New Yorker. The
yeah.
government was asserting that Cohen and other SAC managers had created a corporate culture in which employees were encouraged to obtain proprietary information and make investments on the basis of it. Backing up this idea, 6 former employees have already pled guilty to insider dealing charges, and 2 current employees are awaiting trial. But all they're doing is basically saying, you got to give back some of the money. I mean, this is the functional equivalent of saying, okay, look, you're robbing a bank,
right.
and your punishment is going to be that we're going to charge you double for the gas that you used in your getaway car. You're
right.
we're also going to basically say that, like, hey, this whole thing where you blew through the toll booth, you're going to have to pay that
when you escaped
out of New York City with all your loot. But I hope don't do it again. And we're also going to say you no longer have a license to rob banks unless you're doing it just for yourself. That's
right.
Basically what it is.
Well, it puts me in mind of the scene from Casablanca where the inspector comes into Rick's casino and says he's shocked that there's gambling going on here. You know, it is just so transparently silly that this even when John Cassidy would write a sentence like that, you know, of course that's what they're doing. Of course that's how it's always been done. You know, so this was, you know, Sam Israel, you know, for listeners who don't know the book, what was fascinating to me about Sam Israel's story was not really so much his Ponzi scheme. It was the fact that when he started to cheat, he just assumed everyone else was cheating. And so when he was down, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars and desperate to find a way to save, you know, his skin, he himself got conned. And the reason he was susceptible to that con was because he knew from firsthand experience, he's one of the most distinguished trading families in the history of the country, that everybody cheats all the time. And so when this con man said to him that the Federal Reserve runs a secret bond market, Sam's like, wow, really? Man. And the feeling, I don't know if your listeners remember that day in 2008 when the crisis, really, when the markets just tanked. It's like you really do get this feeling, like, what is behind all this, you know? What's propping it up? What's your retirement money doing? You know, who's benefiting? And is there really a substance to this world of bond and stock trading?
But, you know,
and so, you know, this is, you know, this is very much like that scene in Casablanca where, you know, of course there's gambling going on here. Of course these guys are manipulating events for their own benefit. You know,
but the difference here, though, Guy, I mean, yes. OK, so and I accept the premise that there, you know, that the players who make money in Wall Street are in one way or another front running the market or they are cheating. But when they're caught, isn't the whole idea that we at least for the sake of maintaining the perception that there's rule of law here, we've got to send these guys to jail? I mean, why take any of his money at this point? You know, why not just say, like, you know what? Okay, we're going to revoke your license, or we're just, you know, really, no more parking, you know, for you or something. I mean, why do anything? I mean, for whom is the benefit here? This notion, I mean, you know, I
honestly don't know. I mean, it is an odd thing, you know, so. Really what Stevie Cohen is most guilty of here, it seems to me, and I think Sam would agree with this, is being too good at what he did. So sort of like, you know, it's almost like they need fall guys. And so, you know, who's, you know, the most public kind of successful trader of his generation is Stevie Cohen.
So this is more about like clipping the wings. Like, in other words, okay, you robbed the bank, but we told you guys, don't go out and make big ostentatious purchases the day after we robbed the bank.
It's like in Goodfellas, don't buy the fur coat.
Right. That's right.
Don't buy the caddy.
All right. So let me ask you this. What do you make of this? William Dudley, he is one of the nation's top theoretical banking regulators, because he's the chair of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. This is what he said. What he said at, I guess he was, I don't know, he's given some speech. He said that the problems posed by banks perceived to be too big to fail. He said, essentially, collectively, these enhancements to our current regime may not solve, he's talking about new regulations, may not solve another important problem evident with some large financial institutions, the apparent lack of respect for law, regulation, and the public trust. In other words, he's basically saying, these guys are just criminals, and we don't have the ability or the will, in some instances, to stop them.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean that you know, there is a level of, so, you know, if you sort of want to look at this, you know, a little more abstractly, which isn't always the best thing to do, but in this case it's maybe an interesting thought experiment. You know, the American dollar used to be tied to gold, so there was something underneath it, and then over time it's been untethered from that, so it's really become the currency is a fiat currency, so the Federal Reserve just prints money because it says it can. And the equivalent in the commercial world is banks just, you know, do what they want because they can, and who's going to stop them? You know, where's the break on this? You know, who's going to tell the Federal Reserve you can't print money anymore? Is it, you know, Rand Paul?
Well, I mean, look, I think, frankly, the idea of the Fed printing money is an important way of at least, you know, taking the sharp edge, theoretically, off of you know, economic fluctuations. In this instance, there is a break. I mean, this is what I think this is important about this. You have a regulator saying that our regulations, we cannot fight a culture of criminal idea. But the reality is that there are large statutory answers to this, which could basically inhibit that culture. In other words, if you put on, let's say, a some type of high frequency trading tax, this would start to inhibit it. If you start to say, we're going to outlaw whole classes of financial instruments. I mean, if you set up a regulatory regime to basically say, we're going to shut down parts of this business. We're just going to, it's not providing any societal benefit. You know, it's one thing to have markets that are supposed to deal with, you know, help out commodities, people who are actually involved in trading commodities and delivering commodities. But it's another to create a whole set of these derivatives that have no financial, no benefit to society, but basically are breeding ground for criminals.
So when I moved to New York in 1990, I was a lawyer before I became a writer, and I moved to America from England, and my first job was at Milbank Twee. My only job as a lawyer, I lasted like a year. I hated it. It was a big law firm. And I was just by chance sent to this section called what they call it, securitization. And so it was the beginning of this era of bundling mortgages and car loans and credit card debt and issuing these securities, and that became the basis of the derivatives market, which is what drove, you know, the markets off a cliff. This is the sort of thing where they started betting on the bet of the bet on the bet. And I was like 20 some years old as a kid, and I could see, I mean, literally at that time, could see that this was one big, massive fraud thing waiting to happen. And the reason I knew that is I'd go to these closings, you know, and you go to these corporate, conference rooms, and there's all these exhibits laid out on conference tables, like 100 exhibits, different letters and opinions and agreements and everything. And one of those exhibits was the microfiches from all these mortgages, right? The underlying mortgages were on microfiche in that time. And there'd be like exhibit 27B, the mortgages, and it would be 50,000 mortgages from Florida and Tennessee and all these bundled together, right? I knew that no one was checking to see if there were any actual mortgages there. I knew that no one was checking because it was my job, and I was a kid, and I didn't have a clue what to do.
And they wouldn't even give you,
was checking.
They wouldn't even give you one of those big microfiche readers. You just had to actually hold it up to the light.
That's right. Well, we didn't have light in those days.
Hold it to the candlelight, right? I mean, that was all that. I think this is a stunning admission. I think though, from a guy who sits atop essentially the banks in New York, does it basically say like, you know, we just created a whole culture. I mean, in some ways, it's sort of like the reverse of what we've created with sort of the black market in drugs in this country. The lack of sort of some type of statutory, you know, we can create markets and we can destroy markets through law. And, you know,
the thing about it, Sam, is it's like, you know, it operates, this system operates to the benefit of people, right? It's not like this is happening in a vacuum. It's like these institutions are fee related. These are real people who are, you know, buying beach houses and, you know, eating at nice restaurants and stuff. So it's like there's, you know, who's incentivized to stop this? You know, the anti-Wall Street movement, you know, that was a sort of a moment in time that was interesting. And I thought really showed a lot of promise, but you know, in the quarters of power, there's no one, literally no one, who's incentivized to do anything about this.
You know, it's interesting because there's we're hearing, you know, the of all the things about the Affordable Care Act, and this is, I think, just, you know, this is just a fundamental problem I think we have across within our broader society as a whole, And there's just this massive sort of corruption of our system of law. But it's also just sort of fundamentally, and we've talked about this on this program, you know, in at many different times in the past, but the sort of the ascendancy of money and the accrual of money becoming such a preeminent, like a transcendent value in this country. You know, so many of the complaints we hear about the Affordable Care Act, and some are, you know, there's a whole set that I think are more than relevant. But, you know, I saw Dylan Radigan complaining about his rate increases, and, you know, because he had catastrophic care, and now it's gone from, I don't know, whatever he was paying, $160 to $600 a month for him. And what that signifies, you know, and this is a guy who, you know, at the very least was getting paid $1 million a year for a couple of years on MSNBC. What that signifies is that we're having basically a transference of money from people who are getting low-cost health insurance, socializing that risk on some level. Maybe he wasn't, because he's got millions of dollars, and if he went into the hospital, he'd be able to pay for it. But for the most part, socializing that risk, and also denying poor people and sick people and other subsets of our country, you know, health insurance in some way,
This is one of the things that just you know, this ties into food stamps and just the whole idea of being poor in this society. As a non-American or an un-American.
So un-American. It's unbelievable.
it just continually mystifies me. It's like the governor of Ohio, the Republican, said, you know, just last week, that being poor, the implication in this society is that it's your fault if you're poor.
Definitely.
You know, and I was poor as a kid. My mother was a single mother with three kids and really struggling. And I know, the idea that all these people out there that are trying to, you know, find a way to get health care, or, you know, get through the week with their SNAP money, or, you know, just to get their children clothed and taken care of. You know, I have young children, you know, and they go to a public school, and there's kids in their class who are really struggling, and it's like, it's not an abstraction. It's not some, like, random thing for people to just, you know, put some moral component to it. You know, it's real people and real lives, and I just can never quite get over it. The thing that really stuck with me this week, the headline for me this week in the news, Sam, was, did you see Ted Cruz's father's speech?
Yes, actually. Actually, yes. I spent, I think, an extended period of time doing his accent. But
there you go. But, you know, I did a profile of Tom DeLay 10 years, like a bunch of years ago for GQ magazine, and it's very similar. It's this fire and brimstone thing. But what's underneath all that, right, is it's certainly not Christian in any kind of New Testament way. But it takes, like, anything where you're trying to help another human being and just generalizes it into this war. This basically a world war is going on under this kind of this mindset. And, you know, you never have to worry about an individual kid or a mother or, you know, someone who's sick or lonely. It's just, it's such an insane way of seeing life, you know, that I wonder, you know, this is where Obama, I mean, you know, he has to deal with that reality that, you know, one of the principal, you know, candidates for the presidency next time, at least through his father, if you take his father at his word, holds these incredibly radical views.
Well, I mean, and it's not just him. I mean, look, Paul Ryan was talking about this concept of, you know, but Romney, the same thing, the whole thing of the makers and the takers. But Paul Ryan was like saying, you know, we don't want things like food stamps to become to go from a safety net to a hammock. I mean, the whole implication is that there is something morally wrong with you, that your poverty is a manifestation of a moral issue that you have, or that if we help you in any way because you're poor, it is going to morally degrade you. And this is just absurd. I mean, did you have this in Canada? Does this mentality exist? Did it exist in Canada?
Look, what happened in Canada is reasonably complicated. There are lots of folks in Canada who share this kind of view. But over time, the social safety net has just become something that's not even discussed anymore because it works. You know, because it has improved life. It has improved the situation for all of society, the well-to-do and the poor. And there's not nearly the number of rich people in Canada, of course, but there's nothing like the same number of desperate people. What I hope is, you know, happening in this country slowly with this Affordable Care, you know, turning the Titanic away from the iceberg, but is that this will be shown to work for the larger number of people, and that the couple of percent that lose their plans and, you know, have access to the loudspeakers will not drown out the millions who are going to be able to get, you know, basic care for their children and for themselves, and the people who have had, you know, chronic health problems and haven't been able to get insurance and all those issues. You know, it is incredible, and I think it's incredible to almost everyone in the world, certainly in the Western world, how the United States goes about making these decisions. It's like sticking up the world economy to turn this thing over. Like, to what end?
There was a really interesting piece. There was a report that came out that I saw Matt Iglesias had highlighted a couple of weeks ago. And I guess The report came out from the Journal of Science that shows, they studied low-income people, Americans, at a New Jersey shopping mall. And they looked at farmers in India. And they found that in both instances, when faced with decisions, with financial decisions, under the duress of being already poor, that it literally had a cognitive effect. In other words, that poverty also increases your likelihood that you're going to make poor decisions, which is a fairly obvious thing. I mean, aside from, you know, that being rich makes your life easier, it also makes it easier for you to make better decisions. And the sort of analysis Iglesias did is that, you know, actually handing out money to poor people would actually help them get out of poverty, not just because of the money that you give them, but because they'll be able to sort of, it reduces their stress and makes things a little bit easier. Now, of course, you still need jobs. You still need health insurance, because you could go bankrupt if you get hit by a bus. It's just so strange that we still have this sort of battle that seems to have arisen and become more pronounced.
I read this really, I think I sent it to you, Sam, but there's a companion piece to that that I'm going to post on my Facebook page, which is 100 likes richer than from the last time.
Oh, yes. So we will push the Facebook page. What is the Facebook page? We're going to put the link up on...
It's just Guy Lawson Author. It's like, you know, it's where I'll be posting. I've got a lot of stuff going on, and not to hijack this poverty conversation. So this blog post that I'm going to post up was really, really interesting. It was written by an African-American woman, and it was about her mother and growing up poor and how there are sort of good poor and bad poor, you know, like people who are, you know, there, someone had condemned someone on welfare for having an expensive handbag.
Well, this was the
And she talks about, you know, how the poor are discussed in this kind of like, as if they're not real people way, you know, like as if they're abstractions again. And they're real people. And she writes about her mother buying a nice pair of boots and having a nice set of clothes that she would go to the welfare office in, and how it gave her a sense of dignity, and it empowered her in that situation. And, how this woman basically says, if you haven't been poor, if you're not poor, you don't know what you're talking about. That this thing is so complicated and grinding and hard. And I know that from my personal experience as a child, but I also know that from as a journalist, and I've covered poverty issues over the years. And, poor people are just as vividly real and alive and suffering through and enjoying lives and loves just as much as anybody else. And so, you know, yeah, I can see what Matthew Iglesias is saying about that. And you know, it's that's what a spiral looks like, right?
Right.
You know, it just pulls you down. And how to stop that momentum and reverse it even is like a huge thing. And, you know, and the worst thing in the world you can do to somebody who in that situation is judge them and then deny them basic things like cutting food stamps the way the food stamps are being cut. I mean, what is up with that? $40 billion. What is that, like 3 weeks in Afghanistan?
Yeah, I mean the amount of money that we're it certainly would the $40 billion in cuts would certainly be dwarfed by the amount of money that it would take to bomb Syria when we were contemplating it, which apparently was not so important.
Why stop there? I mean, let's go for Iran.
I want to get back to that piece for a second too, because I'm going to
put it up. It was a really nicely written piece.
It was a really nicely written piece, and the other interesting aspect of it was this: the distinction, the reasons why, you know, like you say, poor people buy status symbols, and there is, like, you know, some efficacy to it as well in some instances, where she talks about the difference between being presentable and being acceptable.
And right, exactly.
Her experience in not just knowing or at least sensing that the way she dressed, beyond being presentable, you know, but where you are part of a club. I'm wearing this designer jacket. I'm wearing this designer suit is basically a signal to the gatekeepers of economic prosperity that you're okay, you know.
Yeah, she writes about how people, white people, have told her, you know, you don't dress like gangster, you know, or, you know, that really helped you get the job here. And she, and the thing that she's amazed by, that she says, it's not just that they think this, that they're telling me that they think this.
Right. I mean, she talks about not even gangster. It's that you're not wearing a halter top. You're wearing a blouse or whatever it is. And that difference of that person sitting in the waiting room or applying for a job is what pushed her over the edge. And yet that halter top versus blouse, maybe a couple hundred dollars difference in terms of buying it, but you don't know which one of those cultural signifiers is the one that's going to get you into the club. I mean, and, you know, this is something that we see all the time, I think, across the board, but it is a much harder decision to make if you have, only so many dollars in terms of resources.
Yeah, you know, I was watched a poverty worker upstate here on a show yesterday that he was discussing like the granular reality of the food stamps or SNAP program, and you know, not the abstraction of we're going to cut these poor people, they got to lift themselves up, this grandiose language and debate that's supposed to be, you know, that is going on around the food stamps issue. You know, it comes down to like decisions of whether you can, you know, afford to get your kid the kind of cereal that his friends eat, you know, or even worse than that. Our kids, you know, go to this public school, and the other day they went early from early mass, and they got to see the kids who are coming in for the breakfast program, you know, the food stamp kids.
Yep.
They're feeding them pizza for breakfast. You know, let's just even talk about how to get well nutritioned.
Right. And that's, you know, probably pizza like left over things, from the day
things,
before.
You know, this is a sort of the converse of what you're talking about. This is like, you know, this is just, you know, having obesity issues and being poor. Like that, those things often go together because you're just being fed garbage. And so, you know, the idea that you would scrimp even more on this stuff and get even more like, you know, refined, high calorie, high fructose, whatever, all the garbage that goes into this mass-produced food, into these people, you know, you're going to not only affect their decision-making ability, you're going to affect their physical health, their longevity, their, you know, their family well-being, all that stuff.
And on top of that, a $5 billion cut in food stamps, which is basically going to drop someone who, you know, 10, 20, 30 bucks a month, but you're talking out of a food budget of like $250 maybe,
exactly.
In some cases $180. They're just, you know, the Times had a story today. Just the first example they're talking about is a 63-year-old guy who lives in South Carolina. He says, "I don't need a whole lot to eat." He spends more than half of his monthly $832 on Social Security income. And we should say that for 50% of the seniors today get nearly 100% of their income from Social Security. Maybe it's around 95%. For two-thirds of seniors, they get at least 50% of their income from Social Security. So he spends half of his monthly income, $832, which he gets from Social Security, to rent a room in a house in East Charleston, South Carolina.
Yeah.
He gets his food stamps has dropped by $9. He's already spent the $33 he gets for November on food. So he then goes to food pantries. You're going to have people crushing these food pantries. I mean, it's just stunning. And this, and we should point out that Democrats kept chipping away at food stamps and did nothing to reverse this this expiration of the bump in food stamps that came with the stimulus thing. Of course, Republicans want to cut it, like you said, to $40 billion beyond where it's being cut now. We have unemployment benefits for 2.1 million workers set to expire within a couple of months. I mean, this is just, it's just stunning.
You know, so, yeah, I remember during the Clinton years in the mid-90s, like the big policy triumph, the bipartisan you know, thing that made Bill Clinton the great president that he is that they quote unquote reformed welfare. You know, so, you know, in these times of like, you know, war and, you know, rampant fraud on Wall Street, like, you know, everyone can agree, let's beat up on the poor.
Yep.
You know, the idea, so when we hang up here, I'm going to go, it's the food pantry day at our kids' school, and I'm just going to go to a supermarket and buy some stuff, which, you know, is good, and we're going to sponsor a family for Christmas presents as we've been doing now for a local charity, which is good. But, you know, like, that's at our discretion. You know, that's like we're doing it because, not, you know, that it should, you know, food should be a right.
Yeah.
You know?
And the reality is that this is the charity is good, but it is no match for the ability of society to deal with these issues. It's just not. And, you know, I don't know. Somehow I don't know if it's gotten worse over the years. Maybe I'm just more aware of it. Maybe it's just become more politicized. But this notion, I mean, because I just don't remember. I mean, I know that it's been more veiled, maybe, and you know, when Reagan's saying, you know, just the government's in the way of things and trickle down will help. But, you know, we just saw a campaign where supposedly the most moderate of all Republicans was literally trying to make the case that, like, you know, we've got some money grubbers, these poor people, essentially, in this country who are not paying federal taxes. And they're running on that.
Yeah, I mean, another thing I didn't realize until I watched this interview about, you know, another common claim you'll hear is fraud, the welfare mother.
Yeah.
Right? Like, do you know that 1%, there's a 1% fraud rate, which is really pretty low when you think about it. But I didn't know this. Most of the fraud that occurs is not from recipients, it's from companies preying on recipients.
They're basically just what on the food stamps. They're what they're reselling. What are they doing?
Yeah, they'll give cash for it. You know, they're just cheating.
Right. Yeah, you know? I mean, and 1% fraud. I don't know. You know, anybody involved in any business that involves, you know.
Well, let's talk about Wall Street.
Wall Street, we're talking probably upwards around 98%. But, I mean, what business does not have fraud? I mean, what private insurance does not have fraud? I mean, what business?
The appropriate response to that is to punish the children. I mean, for me, talking about the awareness of it, Sam, I think having young children and seeing them and their classmates is what's really, like, making it more vivid for me lately. And so I would recommend, you know, just looking at a bunch of school kids walking home, and some big number, like 30 or 40%, are, you know, hungry or, you know, are on food stamps.
Yep.
You know, it's just like anytime you see a bunch of kids walking along the street, like probably one in three of those kids has got food security issues in their life.
Yeah, I mean, and it's I don't know, it's stunning. It's a weird. It's a weird dynamic in our culture today, but Guy, always a pleasure. Folks,
yeah.
All right, let's get clear on this. Your Facebook page, we're going to put a link up to it. It is Guy Lawson, L-A-W-S-O-N. Guy, for some reason, your name is pronounced funny, but it's actually G-U-I. I know in Canada.
G-U-Y, guy. Like, it's spelled like guy.
Right. It's like guy. But
and I really enjoy it. Like, so a bunch of your folks have come on to my Facebook, and I've had some back and forth, but they're just, you know, a really good, active, smart bunch. So, you know, I've got things going on, just to toot my own horn a little bit here. I got a book coming out next year, Arms and the Dudes, which is being developed for a movie to be Todd Phillips' next movie.
Available, incidentally.
Pardon?
I said available from an acting perspective.
Yes, okay. And my first book, The Brotherhood, is really getting pretty far along in development with Warner Brothers as well.
All right.
If people are looking for a movie recommendation, I know you're having Asif Manvi on next. There's a really great movie, a Brazilian movie called Elite Squad 2.
I've seen that.
The director, he's attached to the Brotherhoods.
You're kidding.
No, he's a great
director.
Why not
Elite Squad 1?
I think they redid it with a bigger budget.
No, wrong, dude.
Oh, really?
No, it was a sequel.
Oh, okay.
You got to watch
Elite
Squad
movie.
1. How did you watch Elite Squad? You don't even know the director who's attached to do the book that you did?
Oh, yeah. No, the script's written. They're out to casting, and I could tell you who they
available.
Are. I could tell you they're talking to, Sam, but I would get in trouble. But I can tell you this. Think like the biggest movie star in the world.
All right.
And then Octopus, that book that I discussed in this hour is also being developed by HBO. The guy that writes, one of the lead writers of Breaking Bad, is working on it. And if you like Breaking Bad, you might like Octopus.
Can we agree, though, that we both know the guy who should be playing Sam Israel?
Paul Giamatti?
No. No,
who?
Not Paul Giamatti. You're talking to him.
Who?
All right, Guy.
Who did you say?
Me.
Oh, you're Sam Cedar, man. You'd be pretty good. You got to put on a few pounds.
Funny. Yeah. Well, I'll do it.
Lose a little hair.
I'll do it. All right.
All right, man. It's always great to talk to you, Sam.
Thank you, Guy. All right, folks. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Asif Manvi. About, among other things, he'll give us a movie recommendation, but I really want to talk to him about that amazing piece he did about that North Carolina GOP official on the incredible draconian voting restrictions they have placed in North Carolina. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the show. I don't even know if he remembers that he was on before, frankly. The wonderful Asif Manvi. You may have seen him on The Daily Show, or really, you're also, Asif, you are one of my favorite actors. I don't know if you know that.
Oh, thank you very much.
You've never
said that to me before in all the years I've known you. So
I don't know. I feel like I can open up when there's other people listening.
Now there's like hundreds of people listening. You want to tell me?
Well, I mean, I think I mentioned this last time you were on, but and it was my intention, and I'm going to try and do it. Allow members on our website to view Beat Cops. I hired you to be in this show that I wrote and directed to play two roles, not one, but two different roles.
That was a fun sort of pilot experiment that we did where, I got to play like a doorman outside a hotel and then a super of a building. And the only distinction was that I had a fake mustache in one of them.
That's right, but people didn't notice. A lot of people didn't even notice it was the same person. I mean, that's how,
right.
Honestly,
well,
that's impressive.
That's how stupid people are. They didn't know.
But I think that's also a testament to your abilities. But I also should say, I just spoke to Guy Lawson, and his wife is Maya Kamal. She is... She has a big Indian food, like sauces and this and that. And apparently, she was like a consultant on a movie you did. Dosa.
I made a movie that came out in 2010 called Today's Special, which is available on Netflix, by the way. It's a sort of an Indian foodie movie, rom com. Really fun. And Maya was our dosa specialist.
There you go.
There was one scene where myself and a Bollywood actor named Nasiruddin Shah, we eat dosas. And she was the one off to the side, like, whipping them up, cooking them while And then, if when you make a movie, you got to have, like, five different sets of dosas, all different, like, levels of being eaten so that you can cut back and forth. So the poor woman was just like, kind of making all these doses that were like all, and then they ended up just being cold and, but she's great. Yeah.
There you have it. So there's the worlds that collide. I've known somebody who made your doses, and also products are available. I mean, I think throughout the country now, good stuff. If you like Indian food, it's the best way to try and make it at home. I guess I'm not getting any advertising revenue for that, so I'm not going to push that too hard. Asif, I'm so happy you could join us this week because 2 weeks ago I saw one of the funniest bits I've seen on, not just funny, but it also really, the issue of voter disenfranchisement has been, we've talked about it on this program. Ari Berman is one of the best in the country covering this, but it really hasn't been as mainstream of an issue as it should be. And you went down to North Carolina. Just tell us, just set this up because we're going to play a little clip of it.
We went down to North Carolina and we spoke to this GOP executive committee member down there in Asheville, North Carolina, named Don Yelton. And he was very outspoken about, our researcher, Juliet, found him and spoke to him and kind of got his skinny on the whole thing. And he was very outspoken about why this was not discriminatory, why this was not, racist. But he was also very open about, what it was. And so when we went out to speak to him, I think part of what happened with Don was and sometimes this happens in these interviews where we just stay out of the way,
Right.
Stephen Colbert once told me many years ago that, if you just stay silent, the other person in the interview will continue speaking and eventually they're going to say
that's the old Errol Morris. I think that was like the Errol Morris theory is like you just stay quiet until it's uncomfortable, and they will rush to fill the void.
Exactly. And so, you know, it was one of those things where I didn't really have to stay quiet that long before Don.
All right, let's play this clip, because your response to this was literally, we were watching this when it came out, I guess a couple of weeks ago or so, and we were on the floor. We just kept playing it over and over again. It's such a perfect response. All right, so let's play that. We're going to pick it up mid conversation so that we don't have any copyright issues or whatnot, but we'll pick it up where you have said to him, like, the law is not racist, right? And he says, no, the law is not racist, and then we'll pick it up from here.
Yeah.
Here it is.
Of course the law is not racist, and you are not racist.
Well, I've been called a bigot before. Let me tell you something. You don't look like me, but I think I've treated you the same as I would anybody else.
Right.
Matter of fact, one of my best friends is black.
So one of your best friends?
One of my best friends.
Is black?
Yes.
And there's more.
When I was a young man, you didn't call a black, you called him a Negro. I had a picture one time of Obama sitting on a stump as a witch doctor. And I posted that on Facebook. I was making fun of my white half of Obama, not the black half. And now you have a black person using the term nigger this, nigger that, and it's okay for them to do it.
You know that we can hear you, right?
Yeah.
Okay, you know that. You know that we can hear you.
Yeah.
Okay, all right.
Oh, God. Every time I hear that clip, I can't help it, but... you know that we can hear you. And he's like, oh, yeah, yeah. And then he goes on.
And you know, honestly, it's funny because that clip has gotten a lot of play, and it got picked up by the national media because Don Yeltsin, you know, subsequently was asked to step down.
Right.
From his position down there in North Carolina. And then he got on the radio the next day and sort of called the GOP a bunch of spineless pussies, basically, you know. And sort of said that they were too scared. But the thing is, I think what he really did, and it's later in the interview, you know, I mean, the shocking part is his use of the N-word and his sort of racist, you know, diatribe. But the thing is, what he does actually later, which is much more sort of gives up the game in a much more obvious way, is that he comes out and says that, like, this law is really to disenfranchise Democrats because the
right.
people that it's actually – hurting are sort of minorities and immigrants and single mothers and, you know, people like that. And so, like, you know, he's like, yeah, and those people vote Democrat, and he's kind of like, yeah, and that's just too bad, I guess, you know. Like, if we're going to hurt Democrats, and that's what it is. So he sort of gave up, you know, he kind of gave up the gig a little bit, and I think that's probably why the GOP shut him down as fast as they did, because I think in some ways – you know, he's showing the magic trick, you know,
I mean, but the irony
but I think people are, go ahead.
The irony is that excuse that this is just to shut down Democrats, is almost close to accepted by the establishment media in this country, because that's just politics. You know, and so the fact that they're black, I mean, we know, I mean, basically the calculation is like, we know that what percentage of black people vote for Democrats. So we will disenfranchise black people, but not because they're black, but because they're Democrats. And we can just get away with it because they're black. and if it's, you know, it's a twofer for us. But was there any parts of that you had to cut out?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he went on for a while. In fact, one of his interviews later, he said, and this is the crazy part, is that he actually said, well, I'm surprised they didn't, I said a lot more worse stuff than that they didn't even keep in the interview, you know. And so he sort of remembered.
Well, like what? Like what?
Well, I don't know if he actually said anything worse. I think when he, you know, we played this game with him at one point where we had built a little, like, smiley face with that, which had a Hitler face on the back of it, and sort of, you know, after he had done this whole racism, we were like, okay, why don't you tell us, is this racist, is that racist? Is this racist or not racist? We kind of played this little game, which never ended up in the piece, and he had to sort of you know, either turn the smiley face if it was not racist or the Hitler face if it was racist. And at one point he got completely confused, and I had this line where I was like, you actually don't know which side of that is racist, do you? You don't know it's the Hitler side that's racist. You know that, right? And there was this kind of weird sort of thing which was very funny but never ended up in the piece. And the other thing he also did was he talked about, like, how students should not get to register early because they are influenced by their teachers, and they're influenced mostly to register as Democrats. And so it was kind of this weird thing of, like, you know, students should not be influenced by their teachers kind of thing. So there was a lot that we, you know, these interviews sometimes, you know, we have to edit them down for time, obviously, right. You know, but there was a lot of stuff that he said that we didn't actually leave in because it's only a 5-minute piece, you know?
Right. And how do you, like, how do you decide that you're going to do a piece? I mean, do you get pitched from the writers there? Like, let's do a piece on voter disenfranchisement, or, I mean, how do you?
Yeah, usually it's, you know, there's a sort of pitch email that the Daily Show has, and usually one of the producers or one of the writers or somebody has pitched an idea. And this was an idea that was pitched by one of our producers, and then I was assigned to it with Dana Friedman, who was the producer on it. And you know, we sort of do a round of, you know, what the questions are going to be. We talk to the writers on the show about, like, how we can make this funny and stuff like that, and then we go down there with questions and ideas for games, like the little Hitler smiley right. face thing, which was a game that we sort of planned to do with him. And then a lot of the gold stuff happens, like, in the moment, you know, because there's the whole variable that you're dealing with, which is this other person that you don't know what they're going to say. And then when you have someone like Don, where he just goes off, and that was never planned, that he was going to go off like that and just kind of start, you know, spouting all this racist stuff. And so that's, like, you know, that's in Daily Show terms, that's kind of just, you know,
yeah, it just struck gold.
Just,
I mean,
admitted, yeah, it's gold, you know.
Well, I mean, do you guys sit around and go, like, I can't believe that any of these people will still come on the show?
Well, that was the concern, I think, when he got fired. It was, I think, the main concern of the Daily Show was, like, oh, wait a minute, people aren't going to talk to us if they get fired. You know, like, as much as we were happy that, you know, like, something had been done, at the same time, we were kind of, like, not really wanting to take too much credit for that, you know? Because
right.
It's like, you know. And again, like, usually people don't get fired. This is one of those things where I think also it's really just bad timing for him, because the GOP down in North Carolina is actively reaching out to African-American voters. And then he's on television saying the N-word, you know, so I think the timing was just such that,
well,
they just couldn't ignore it.
There's
know?
Been, I mean, through, I mean, there was throughout, like, the spring and the summer, there was massive protest at the North Carolina State House on these Moral Mondays. They just kept growing and growing.
Yeah.
Specifically because of this, I mean, there were other things, but it was just voter disenfranchisement. And then I think the DOJ, I think, is, I believe, is if they're not suing them already, are looking too soon. I mean, it's pretty. I don't know. It was pretty stunning. And Asheville's sort of the most liberal part of that state, isn't it? I mean, Asheville, or I don't know.
Asheville is pretty, yeah, it's pretty liberal. You know, I mean, we talked to a lot of Democrats down there as well. You know, I mean, they didn't end up in the piece where we end up speaking to a lot of Democrats on the street and stuff about this and how, you know, angry they were about this issue. I mean, it's clearly a huge topic, not only nationally, but specifically in North Carolina.
Yeah.
We happened to just tap into that at the right time, and I think that's why it became such a big story. And then once he got fired, I think it just, you know, it almost felt like the Daily Show had actually, one of our stories had actually made a difference, which is kind of a bizarre thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an incredibly important story. Just regardless of whether or not the guy gets fired at that point, just to sort of get it into the mainstream. And I still
right. Well, I think, you know, I spoke to a bunch of lawyers and They were explaining to me that, like, you know, voter disenfranchisement is a very difficult thing to sort of explain to the average person. It's kind of, you know, it's very legal. There's a lot of legalese in it, and it's kind of, you know, and it's hard to sort of explain why, you know, we spoke to John Lewis, the congressman from Georgia, and he was sort of saying it's racist as well. But, you know, like, why is it actually racist? And I think sometimes in a piece like that, it sort of boils it down, you know.
Right.
It kind of boils it down to very simple sort of terms that people can understand, because it is a very complicated thing to kind of connect the dots to know why does you know, because if you say to somebody, like, listen, everybody should have an ID when they vote, like the average person will be like, well, that makes sense to me, you know. But when you break it down, you realize, like, okay, this is why you are disenfranchising certain sectors of society by doing that, you know, or making this, which seems like a sort of common sense thing, but it actually does disenfranchise a lot of people.
Right. And your piece actually just sort of showed that there is the people who are instigating this type of legislation are fully aware of what the results and the impact will be, whether it's disenfranchising black people or disenfranchising Democrats. They know that they are disenfranchising people. And
yeah, absolutely. I think, and that's what I think was really scary about the piece, is that he really came out and just said that. And, you know, that's the thing, is that, like, when you talk about, like, sort of, you know, early registration, and you realize, like, okay, 70% of African Americans vote early, you know, these statistics, and then if you take the early registration days down from 7 days to 4 days or whatever, then, you know, you're disenfranchising so many people, or, you know, things like that. So you realize, like, oh, okay, this has an effect that is beyond just sort of what it seems to be on paper, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's great stuff. And so, but let's pivot, because I know you, you don't have much time. I want to get a movie recommendation from you, as you know.
Oh, you do?
Yeah. Well, as you know, I now have two children. We ran into each other on the subway the other day, and I don't know if I showed you pictures of my now 8-month-old son. But
yeah,
so I'm not getting out of the house as much as.
So you want a movie recommendation, like, for you, like, you want, because you're at home, like, wanting to rent movies,
yes,
watch movies,
right? Exactly.
Right.
I mean, I, ostensibly, some of the people listening might be interested too. But, you know, some of this is for me and some of this is for them. And
right,
I'm stuck
right,
in the
right.
house. So, you know, if I'm lucky, at like
well,
9
listen,
o'clock.
I mean, you know, I would have to recommend the movie that I made with your friend who was our DOSA woman, you know. And that is the movie Today Special, which is on Netflix.
How could I not watch that movie now that I know
watch
who
it.
Made the DOSA?
Exactly. So you have an inside scoop into it. But that movie is terrific, and whatever. It sort of feels weird for me to be like, it's a great movie. But it genuinely is a sort of a heartfelt film which is very funny, and it's about food. So if you're a foodie at all, you would love it. And it's funny. I wrote it with a guy named John Bynes, who used to be one of the former Daily Show writers and now writes for Jimmy Kimmel.
Oh.
And so he is a great, funny guy. He's also a huge foodie. He used to be a food critic for the New York Press, and we were in a sketch comedy group together called The Associates back in the 90s in New York. And John and I got together, and I had written this one-man show called Sakina's Restaurant, which played off-Broadway for a while, about an Indian family that owned a restaurant on 6th Street. And he was a food critic and a comedy writer. And so we kind of got together and said, why don't we write an Indian food movie? And so we did. We wrote this movie, and it's set in Jackson Heights. And it's a tandoori comedy. So it's a lot of fun. So, you know, if you're a foodie, if you love comedy, if you love it's kind of a chick flick, but it's great.
All right. Well,
that's great.
I mean,
you is a family movie. You would love it.
I'm going to get the whole family around the television, if only because you know, my kid's going to be interested just to see Maya's doses.
Right. There's a couple F-bombs, so, like, you know, you might want to just, like, close.
Ooh, well, she may hit you up for like $2 per F-bomb. I literally was listening to one of Marin's podcasts the other day, and she just got enraged about how many times he swears on that thing.
Who did?
My daughter. I mean, she was
oh,
in the.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, she was supposedly in the other room, but she came in. She's like, I've been hearing Marc Maron swear through that whole thing. He owes me $8.
That's great. I'll give him money. That's fine. Yeah. That if she good. Watches it, I'll,
this
give,
is actually,
I'll give him money.
This show runs on membership, but 97% of the show is financed through membership. The other 3% is getting my daughter to collect fees from people I know who swear in media.
Who swear?
Yeah.
That's how the show stays afloat. That's great.
Yes. Asif Manvi, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks, man.
People
will
check out today's special. We'll put a link on majority.fm. I appreciate you coming in.
All right, thanks a lot.
I guess he didn't actually come in. He just came on the phone, but I still appreciate that.
We appreciate that you took the time to talk
with
us. Yeah,
that's what I meant to say. So, folks, we've got a late-breaking Jimmy Reefer Cake song. Jimmy, of course, is ecstatic because in Portland, they voted overwhelmingly to decriminalize marijuana. Now, it's still illegal in his state, but... I wonder if Jimmy Reefercake will be the test case for whether or not the municipal laws will trump the state ones. But at the very least, we know that's going to push in the right direction. So let's, well, before we get to the Jimmy Reefercake song, maybe we should talk about the one decent editorial I saw this week in the New York Times, which, let me get this out here. This is a New York Times editorial, which references a paper in the winter issue of the Journal of Policy Analysis and Management. Now, people have to see this paper in light of the context that we now have two states that have fully decriminalized marijuana. We have the federal government that has allowed for this decriminalization as long as it meets certain guidelines that have basically to do with just sensible regulation and taxation. We see this referendum in Portland. We know that there's medical marijuana is becoming more and more legalized across the country. Two researchers, D. Mark Anderson of Montana State University and Daniel Rees of the University of Colorado at Denver, report that legalization of marijuana for medical purposes has been associated with reductions in heavy drinking, especially among 18 to 29-year-olds, and with an almost 5% decrease in beer sales. Now, that would mean that that medical marijuana legislation may be a little bit leaky. In addition, the increase in legal drinking age from 18 to 21 seems to encourage greater marijuana use among people among people under 21, usage that drops sharply when they reach legal drinking age. The consequences are far from clear, but assuming the argument that alcohol and marijuana are substitutes bears out, that could be good news, especially for road safety. Of the two substances, alcohol is far more hazardous. For the most part, according to road tests, marijuana-intoxicated drivers show only modest impairments. Several studies have suggested that drivers under the influence of marijuana actually overestimate their impairment. In other words, they get a little paranoid that they may be driving too quickly or too close to the car in front of them. And if I recall correctly from my youth, I would hear stories of people who would drive when they were high. And that jibes with the stories I heard of people who would. They slow down and they increase their following distance. The opposite is true of drivers under the influence of alcohol. Which I did not hear as many stories about when I was a youth. All right, let's hear the late-breaking entry from Jimmy Reefercake, a maniac himself. What is the song, Matt?
It is called "Anyone But Paul LePage," whatever he would say his last name.
Governor LePage had some more ridiculousness. In some ways, he's sort of. Not quite, but like our version of Rob Ford, right? I mean, just sort of like He's out there. I don't, I'm not saying that he's involved in anything illicit. Minus the crack. That we know of. Go ahead.
They could both use some weed.
Yeah.
Right, for Jimmy Reaver cake.
Let's hear it.
I hate my governor. My governor's insane. I hate my governor. Don't let Paul pay. Anyone else will do.
Will do.
For some reason he refused the Medicare expansion. For some reason he changes the poverty level. In other words, you are below income. And you should agree with me, Paula Page is the devil.
I got screwed.
Yet, there he goes again. Talking about it. There he goes again. Oh, poor little Polly grew up poor. Poor Paula Page was a poor, abused young boy. Sorry, Polly. And that doesn't explain why you want to take it out on the people of the state of Maine. Or maybe it explains it all too well.
Wow. Is there a weed reference in there? I did not catch it. I was doing a little bit of a Tiny Tim thing there. How did you pick up on that?
It was very emotional, too. Like, you could hear the feelings in Jimmy Reaper Cake's voice.
Indeed. I guess we're doing a Freebie Friday today.
God. So rare.
You know what? This is
so
not a Freebie Friday. Listen. Okay, listen. You, I used to say when we were doing just exclusively radio, when it was free for everybody, we didn't even have podcasts back then because Air America couldn't get their act together. But I used to say, today's show is not free. You got to take a quarter and put it on the dashboard, or you got to turn off your radio. But I'm going to say today that you need to go to podcastawards.com. All right? I mean, I make a pitch for you to become a member every day. You're obviously not doing that.
They're already voting on podcastawards.com. What they have to do if they're going to listen to the rest of the show is have someone else also vote for us on podcastawards.com.
Ba-bing.
Whether it be your parents, your children, your cousins, your aunt, uncle, whatever.
Even someone you accost on the street.
Co-workers.
Subway.
All right. Well, there you go, folks. So if you're hearing the sound of my voice right now, you are probably preparing to accost somebody. The number is 646-257-3920. That reminds me. 646-257-3920. Let's get to the IMs. I just want to say this. George W. Bush scheduled next week to be a keynote fundraiser in Irving, Texas, for the Messianic Jewish Bible Institute. This is the group of Jews for Jesus. They are set up around the world to convince Jews to accept Jesus as the Messiah and to restore Israel and bring about the second coming of Christ. Last year, the keynote speaker was Glenn Beck. I'm sure, I don't know what, it's unclear whether or not Bush is getting paid for this. It just seems to be, right.
There's something.
Well, I mean, it just seems like a weird thing to sort of come out. Maybe he does this all the time, and it just happens to be this group, but I'm sure he's just like, I like it. They're Jews, but they like Christ. It's just like all tipsy-turvy. Can't quite, Hey, Laura! Laura, check this out! They're Jews! Like Christ! So, in other words, they're like, they got a rabbi, but he's like a priest.
Shalom to that.
Yeah, I get you.
I want to find, it'd be like a Muslims who like George, like me.
That's right.
I want to find that group next.
No, it's, that's not just a, they all got a, I don't get it. Laura. So there you have it, folks.
So it makes up a little bit for killing the guy a couple thousand years ago.
That's right. I should have figured out to like them about 2,000 years ago. Am I right?
That's his opener. I bet Jesus would appreciate it if you guys thought about this. Like
that's
this
right. Time. You guys are a little late to a party, but I'm glad to be here. Maybe if you hadn't killed him the first time, he wouldn't have to come back. Am I right? So, anyways... two Jews go into a bar, and then they just say that they love Jesus, and that's the important thing. So there you have it. I really don't know what to make of that. I just had to bring it up. Let's go to the IMs, shall we? Spence, like, how's it both the male and female winners of the New York City Marathon were from Kenya? Do you think Obama fixed it? Interesting theory.
There's sort of a sad story coming out of the marathon. For the oldest woman who was running, she was 86. She does it every year, apparently. She ran, and she fell and hit her head. And they let her continue because she wanted to, even though they probably should have let her not. And then the next morning, she appeared on the Today Show, like she usually does, to talk with Al Roker. And then a few hours later, they found her dead in the hotel room because of the injuries to her head.
Oh, God. Wow, that is sad. Wow.
It just reminded me of that. I don't know why, but sorry.
I mean, I guess...
We're about to go to a little, you know, I guess Kenya Obama riff.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I guess, you know... I don't imagine she would want to, I don't know.
You're trying to say she left on a high note?
I mean, I think, no, look, I think you know, if you're someone who's doing that, I mean, I think, you know, that is that central to, you know, what makes you happy. There are worse ways of going out, I guess. But somebody should have taken her to the hospital after.
Yeah.
Just to be checked, right?
I mean, she appeared on the Today Show with, like, bandages on her head, but, I mean...
Ew. So she had obviously gotten medical treatment, no?
But it could have been right there at the marathon. Yeah. Who knows if she actually went to a hospital.
Dez222, tying your currency to a finite resource is, by definition, inflationary. See 1800s history. Well, the problem with tying your currency to a finite resource, in addition to... there not being enough gold to support the size of the world economy now, is that it gives you no flexibility to deal with with economic crises. Left Coast Marcus. Been voting daily for the Majority Report on the Podcast Awards website. Thank you. Members are the best. Actually, I've been going down the list and listening to some of the other nominees, and none of them even come close to the Majority Report. A lot of them seem to be Christian and or right-wing based podcasts. I guess they know how to rally their base. Easy, really. Just ring a bell and they salivate. It's a tough call for People's Choice between the Majority Report and Taylor Talk, the Taylor Swift podcast. The reality is that the quality guest commentary and insight of the Majority Report is unparalleled. The cream rises to the top. Here's hoping it's a three-peat. Also, just for the record, while Rob Ford may be an addict on the way to his bottom and clearly needs help, he is still a national embarrassment. Theo Ward, what's with the obsession with the gold standard among libertarians and the like? If I was a progressive, Alex Jones, I'd say it's a Rothschild clandestine plot. They want to keep their Scrooge McDuck-esque mountains of money from devaluing. Read between the lines, people. They want to amass all the money and make us real Americans wage slaves forever so they can advance their reptilian agenda to heat up the earth to suit their lizard physiology. Your thoughts? I think the gold standard stuff is really just there are people who make money selling gold. And they advertise on radio. I really do think that's a lot of it. I mean, that's my feeling. But I get what you're saying. That's it. That would be that was what Alex Jones would do if he.
But I think it transfers into because what Guy was kind of, I think, implying a little bit is that there's another line of people who have this notion that with the gold standard, that just automatically means there's less BS, basically. Which I don't buy as an argument, but I think that that's like a separate.
I think people have trouble wrapping their head around the idea that saying that we have a fiat currency is not a bad thing. Particularly since, well, almost exclusively because of the nature of our fiat currency. In terms of it being the vast, basically the world's reserves currency. It's not 100%. I think it's like maybe 65% of the world's reserves are in dollars. And the fact that we have a robust economy and we have sovereign control over that currency. But we see, you know, what happens to a country like Greece where they don't. Where they are locked into and don't have the flexibility to print money. Umar's, I don't think Christie is a complete dumbass. We can safely assume he won't do anything to jeopardize his presidential chances, and there's no personal advantage for him not to properly spend government Sandy money unless he transferred it to a secret Swiss account. How do you make sense of the inaction regarding Sandy money? He wants to be elected governor first with a wide margin. And so he gives that money to projects around the state, to people who can deliver him votes, i.e. county officials here, county officials there, Democratic county officials, Republican county officials, doesn't matter. I think this guy knows where his bread is buttered. Some of it is in plain view. They rebuilt Seaside before they got people who were just Seaside after the fire. After they got displaced homeowners inside. I mean, so Umar's, the GOP thinks that if you're hungry, it's because you're lazy. I saw a chart with a percentage of food insecure Americans jumped up distinctly right after the 08 economic collapse. So I ask you, Sam, what makes more sense? This jump was caused by rich people on Wall Street were trying to get richer or millions of Americans spontaneously getting lazier at the same time? Of course, of course. In honor of Casual Friday, another game recommendation. If you're ever allowed to get a PS3, The Last of Us. It's been called a Citizen Kane moment for gaming history in terms of its jump in quality storytelling up there with The Road and post-apocalyptic narratives. Plus, the drama is particularly powerful for men with young daughters. Oh, I don't want to get involved in something like that, buddy. I cried like a baby reading The Road. Like a baby.
I cry like a baby watching The Counselor.
That's true. And even like E.T., I cried like a baby.
Mentos commercials.
It's, you know, it's like Mila is so sensitive to watching. Like E.T., she cried hysterically. She cried hysterically during Harry Potter. Just at the parts when they keep referring to how he misses his parents. And so we punished Mila. Being forced to dump millions in toxic derivatives was sort of dragging me down. Then I realized this was the perfect time to log on to podcastawards.com. Now I feel great. Bush and Chains, whopping 932,000 Americans drop out of labor force in October. Participation rate drops to fresh 35-year low. Yes, it's stunning. D. Willingham, Sam, Sammy, I can't believe you let that slam regarding you, your hair go. Lawson said you needed more hair. WTF, no, less hair to play Sam Israel. Obama didn't lie when he said if you like your plan, you can keep it. No provision of Obamacare legally requires any plan to be canceled. It only sets the minimum standard of insurance that you're allowed to have to avoid the tax penalty. It's the insurance companies who are lying when they blame a cancellation on Obamacare. They really ought to blame on their business plans. That's true.
And also, can I think what
that's true, technically speaking. But I think the implication of what Obama was saying was that this will not cause insurance companies to cancel their plans. But remember, we're talking about 5% of the people who are in the private insurance market. A fraction of those are getting cancellation notices, and a fraction of those policies exist year to year, 17% of those. Here's the price you pay for the better half. They started digging upstairs again. If there's such a high demand for these junk policies, then we should soon see a nice little cottage industry of underinsurers crop up in the free market operating outside of the Obamacare exchanges. Don't hold your breath, though. No, I do not think you can get licensed to sell that kind of insurance. How come nobody, Kadam, mentions action star Manvi from the last Airbender movie? I love the moment during Manvi's interviews when he does that nod to camera because he knows what's coming next and the dude delivers. How come... he did it again. Ronald Reagan, Sam, loved your discussion with Guy on poverty. Republicans love comparing federal spending to household spending, but for the analogy to hold up, Dad would have to come home in a new Ferrari and announce to his wife and kids that he's quit his job, you know, in order to increase revenue. Yes, and that to access shoes, food, and shelter for the children would expire in 6 months unless they went out and found part-time jobs. Indeed. All right, let's go to the phones. We got somebody calling in on Skype. Who's this? You're on. You're calling on Skype. Who's this?
Hi, this is Kim in Los Angeles.
Hi, Kim. How are you?
I'm good. So I have a movie to recommend that's on Amazon, Netflix, and it's called Terms and Conditions May Apply. I just saw it this week, and it's about what happens after you say, I agree, after you click, I agree, on any of those agreements you have to agree to before you can use their program on the computer. And that's really good.
We will check it out. Terms and conditions may apply.
Yeah. Google and Facebook do not come out looking very good.
I'm not terribly surprised by that, but
right.
All right, yeah. I appreciate the call. I got to jump, but I appreciate the call. Terms and conditions may apply.
Yeah.
Okay. Ronald Reagan, Sam, loved your discussion with the guy. Oh, yeah, we just did that. Matt Maher, we have to rely on a comedy show to do hard-hitting fact-based reporting on denying people the right to vote while the mainstream media is off chasing ghosts about Benghazi. Pathetic. Buggy, would love to hear from Asif on his views on Jon Stewart's I'm Just a Clown defense when people call out The Daily Show for pushing third-way grand bargain radical centrism. If I was Asif, this is how I would respond to that. Pass. He seems surprised but pleased that his yelling piece contributed to the discussion over and above being funny. And I can only assume that's true for Stewart, too, but maybe not. I can honestly tell. I can't honestly tell with Stewart. Yeah, I don't know. That's a tough call. 626, how can Ted Cruz run for president? According to his Wikipedia page, he was born in Canada. Yeah, that's the one thing that never came up in the Obama birth certificate thing, is that he was born of American parents, or one of them anyways. Did you see OSHA wants to post on the job injuries online? No problem from Walmart. AN8VTXN. Interesting. I'll check that out. Carl Sagan, any thoughts on the strongest typhoon ever recorded or the decision at Fukushima to begin moving nuclear rods? Wait, is there another typhoon coming? I'm worried about what's going on in Fukushima. I don't believe that we can believe what TEPCO is saying, and this is bad. It's bad.
Gaius Publius at Ameriblog is covering this a lot.
Yeah.
So I would.
I've spoken to him on Ring of Fire. Maybe we'll have him on in the future to talk about it. I mean, it's bad. Ben, what would the implications of state law be on pot if we ended up with a Republican administration or Justice Department in 2016? Do you believe this subject will arise in the 2016 campaign cycle? No, but I bet we'll see it in 2020. I think we're just going to keep seeing states do this more. I mean, I think it's going to arise in this. If I was the Democratic Party, I would be pushing this as a ballot initiative in every state in the country. That and raising the minimum wage. And President Obama came out today and said he endorses a Democratic plan in the Senate to raise the minimum wage to $10 plus. That's a buck more than he said in the State of the Union. If the Democrats somehow get it through their heads that they should be pushing this for 2014, they're going to find that it's going to be very beneficial to them politically. PGH, when I hear people talk about the poor, basically what I hear is these people's lives are just like mine, minus the having to go to work part. Yeah. Good point. MREX, voted. Thank you. Kevman, do you think we'll solve tensions with Iran diplomatically? If so, do you believe it will be successful and as important as, say, the Camp David Accord? I think, it remains to be seen with Kerry what he's doing here, but this would be huge. It would be huge. And I think Camp David was huge at the time. Sadly, I think it looks, well, it's still pretty relevant, but it has not had the impact that it was supposed to be. I think that this, if this continues on in this path, it could fundamentally change our disposition towards the Middle East, right?
I mean, totally. There's the ramifications of this, both and the way we relate to Saudi Arabia and potentially the way we relate to some issues around Israel are huge. And I think, you know, Obama deserves really big credit for this.
Yeah.
He's been, I mean.
And Kerry, too.
Kerry, definitely. But the whole time, you know, and he's done some things that I don't necessarily agree with sanctions and everything else. But there's always been the intention to solve the Iran issue like this. And now he's pushing back against Congress because idiots like Rubio are trying to actually increase sanctions right at the moment when this could really happen. But it's right there. It's totally possible, and both sides want it, and it's pretty amazing, and they deserve a lot of credit.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. No, that's good.
Enough, Michael. Okay.
No, that's not what that was about. Muggy Jones. I'm getting a little bit annoyed by the scraping up above. I don't know if it's picking up on the microphone. It's probably not, but it's super annoying. Like, you just... Muggity Jones, never hear anyone coming home and abusing their family after a night of smoking pot, but you hear it all the time after people drinking. Indeed. Bright Bartlett, Sam, have you ever approached about becoming a Jewish for Jesus? Yes, and I have to say that back in the day when I didn't have a family and I was actor, comedian, and really from the age of like 18 to 35, I would seek out any religious fanatic and engage in them with a conversation. Like, I literally, when Benjamin and I used to live together in Somerville, Mass, we used to have, I think it was Seventh-day Adventists or Mormons come to our door. Maybe it was Jehovah's Witnesses. Sorry. Yeah, Jehovah's Witnesses. And I swear to you, they would say, "We have to go now." Like, I would keep them engaged in conversation for so long that they would be like, we really, this has been great, but we really have to keep going. And I wasn't confrontational. I mean, I was just, I would get, Mormons would show you like their book. They had like a cartoon book at the time of Joseph Smith getting the special Bible and all of it. Lone dissenter. I'm a member, and I accidentally signed up twice, and I'm getting charged twice. I would like to cancel and start from scratch. Is there an option canceling my membership on the website? You got to do that through PayPal, but just email us at majorityreporters@gmail.com, and we will fix that for you, and we will rebate you what we can. Ian Long's done. The woman who died after the marathon refused to go to the hospital because she said she felt okay. She also had previously said she loves running so much she'd like to die while running. It's sad, but it's also kind of poetic and beautiful. Yeah, that's, I guess, what I was trying to say sloppily. Let's go to the phones. You call them from a 773 area code. Who's this?
Hello.
Hello. Who's this?
This is Blaine from Chicago.
Hey, Blaine, how's it going?
Okay. I just wanted to call in because I think you just said something that wasn't true. I'm not a birther. But I have studied birthers very in depth, and there's one fact they get right that most liberals get wrong. Barack Obama's mother was born in the United States and was a United States citizen, but that does not make Barack Obama a citizen because they changed the law when he was 4 years old. But his mother hadn't spent the continuous 5 years before he was born in the U.S., and that was actually a requirement to bestow citizenship on your child if you were less than 21 years old when that child was born. And I believe she was 19 when he was born. Hmm. So the only reason that Barack Obama is a United States citizen is because he was born in Hawaii. His father, of course, was Kenyan, so his mother didn't confer citizenship on him either.
Okay, fair enough. I appreciate that. You've really dug into this.
Yeah, yeah. It changed when he's 4 years old. Actually, now if your mother's 19 and you're born, you would be a citizen. But when Barack was born, it actually does not.
And was there a grandfather clause to that? In other words, was it retroactive citizenship?
No. Nope. No grandfathering.
Okay. All right. Well, I appreciate the correction. Duly noted.
No problem.
Okay.
But he is a citizen.
Yes. No, I agree. All right. Okay. I appreciate the call.
No problem.
I like how Sam said. Yeah, I agree.
That's fascinating.
That is interesting. Yeah,
it is. I did not know that.
To be honest, when I heard the call,
wait a second. How old is Ted Cruz?
Ooh.
I wish there was some type of resource where we could find out what his age was. Why don't I know?
Well, he's 42 now.
Oh, okay. So he would have been fine then, according to this last caller, because the law was changed 5 years after.
And how old is Obama now?
Obama's like 50 now, isn't he?
52.
Mm-hmm.
So Ted Cruz just skims by, it seems.
What of that? What are we to make that Ted Cruz is supposedly only 42? I have studied and done an analysis of his male pattern baldness, and I think, frankly, he is older than that, but they have hidden that from us. Tom Frackman. Sam, I just had a crazy thought. What if someone clipped what you did as Deuce and put it on YouTube and had a little title like pro-American radio host tells off liberal feminist. Do you want to guess the comments in response to that? To further the prank, imagine if you had a fake radio station page and played it basically a montage of Deuce. I wouldn't be surprised if conservative media were praising you in the morning and there was a demand for Deuce in their radio markets. The real question is, could you get away with saying anything as long as it had a conservative bent? I guess they might catch on with the 10th anniversary of Deuce. Interesting experiment indeed.
I don't think it would work on YouTube because, I mean, seeing Sam would completely throw it off.
I look like such a metrosexual. It would be like impossible for me to be saying
no,
this.
No, but I also mean people will obviously have come across Sam Cedar on MSNBC or something.
Right.
So they would get to it a lot quicker than the 10-year anniversary.
People will be on YouTube like, he looks to me like someone with a friend named Asif.
Yeah. But actually, the idea of doing the radio clips is actually a really good idea. If somebody wants to set up that site,
a complete site.
What's that?
Like complete.
It doesn't have to be terribly.
The Ken, Ken, and Ken show.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't have to be terribly. I'll write up some of the stuff like the about page. This show was started by Ken, Ken, and Ken. Ken and Ken left. And the first Ken had taken the nickname The Deuce because he was the second Ken of the Ken, Ken, and Ken show and wanted to be distinguished from the other Kens. One whose name kept was Ken. The Deuce called himself The Deuce, and the third Ken called himself The Thrice. Both Ken and Thrice left, but The Deuce kept his name and the name of the show.
Deuce was joined by Rex and Ira, two young Americans repulsed by the Obamatards generation.
You would be great if it actually took off with conservatives and we convinced them to shorten the name of the show in discussion to the KKK show.
The real question is, how do we make money off it, though? We would have to have YouTubes where it's just audio. Like, we still can't figure out the camera in the studio yet. Rowan, Sam, awesome interview with Guy Lawson. I learned about Octopus during a previous interview with him on a show. It's an excellent book, proof positive that truth is stranger than fiction. Also, I second The Last of Us. Louis Brandeis, could you do a lesser show on the Prepper Industrial Complex sometime? The scheme is underreported. Like Alex Jones, the Prepper premise is based on kernels of truth surrounded by a bunch of scare tactics nonsense. Jeremo, Sammy, great show. Can't stop singing. Look through the window. What do you see? Wait, what is that?
It's the glass song.
Right, right. Alex Jones. Alex Jones is influenced by the trend guru Gerald Celente. Yes, they promote gold, and that's why they sell these CTs, Love Bad News and Catastrophes. Yeah, Celente is like, I bet you Bush and Chains is a big Celente fan. Why don't we hear about Governor Christie in association with Madoff and his DOJ expense account scandals? We will. I think we're going to hear about other scandals. I hear things about some of the promotions that he may have made while he was a USA, but we'll see. Triangle Bill, Sam, just voted at podcastawards.com. Yes, there are pending lawsuits related to massive voter disenfranchisement, the NAACP charging racial bias, and their ongoing investigations by the DOJ. Asheville has become fairly liberal because there is a budding moving industry both in Asheville and Wilmington, but the Western Mountains are extremely conservative, as are all the rural parts of the states. Nation magazine just ran with a cover of President Obama and his high school buddies grinning around a big cake decorated with pot leaves drawn on icing. Their group was called the Chum Gang. Article is good analysis of the politics of weed decriminalization. Geeky Dork Girl. Movie suggestions. Boy, it's on Netflix. Okay for Mila. Will you write that down for me, boy? I've also seen Terms and Conditions May Apply. Highly recommended, says Cooch Shamanis. At the end of the film, they show how Mark Zuckerberg's behavior changes when he thinks the cameras are off. Oh. By the way, voted. Thank you. Flavahan. Largest storm ever measured. Typhoon Haiyan. Developing now. Oy. Not off the coast of Japan, is it? Must be because of abortion and gays. Ronald Reagan. Special Bible, Sam. They were golden plates containing the writings of Native American Jews. Dave with Dignity. You following this? Socialists in Seattle may pull off close victory in city council election. Really?
She lost.
Wait, what? Wow. May win, brah. Wow. All right. I love it. Kyle. Ken, Ken, and Ken brought to you by the Heritage Foundation, Hillsdale College, and that place Clarence Thomas' wife works at now. She's worked at those other two places. The final I am of the week. Hey, His Silva. Guys, you can do the fake show Daft Punk style with helmets. Oh, wait a second. Late breaker. Dave with Digny wants me to push votesawant.org to get information on that vote count for the socialist in Seattle. Votesawant.org. We'll post it on the blog. All right, folks. See you Monday.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I get somewhere the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess I lost my drive between the 101 and the 5. Do you know how far the detour takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. Shifted in and out of gear, waiting for my moment to happen. I don't know how much longer I can stay in, or how much more I got to pay to play in. I know somehow my life's got grading, somewhere before the credits fading. From my pilot light shining, pilot light shining bright.